Hello, beloved community. Welcome to the October 20th, 2025 episode of Out on the Edge, where co-hosts Judy McCord, Robin Hamilton, and Betty Priu invite folks to discuss topics relevant to being gay and gray in these interesting times. Today, our guest is Percy, a young trans man whose long-term goal is to help people build skills for understanding and contributing to a civil society. Good communication, including ways we can separate truths from fictions in the relentless floods of words crashing over us 24/7 from social and corporate media. So welcome, Percy. Okay, our show is brought to you by the Orange County, North Carolina Department on Aging. We broadcast every Monday afternoon, 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern, over WCOM-LP Chapel Hill Carborough at 103.5 FM. We also stream over WCOMFM.org. You can find previous shows on the Orange County Department on Aging website at www.orangecountync.gov/OOTE. The Department on Aging website also explains the wide range of elder and caregiver resources and services available in Orange County. We acknowledge that the town of Carborough, where we sit, and the surrounding land was originally part of the Saponi people's territory, including the Eno, Tutelo, and Shikori nations. Judy and Percy, now over to you for the show.
Hi. Great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Percy. First would like you to let us know where you are right now in terms of what you're bringing to Carborough.
Sure. I'm kind of in the middle of my educational journey. We were just talking about this a little bit off mic. I have been living in Carborough for, I think, coming up on 3 years now. I've worked in academic writing coaching. I've worked in libraries. I've done a million other jobs. I've been a youth theater instructor. But my training and my master's degree is in library and information science. So that's a little bit of background behind the preamble. Outside of academics, and obviously my research interests really lie in the information ecosystem and the ways that we interpret it. Outside of that, I'm very passionate about theater, screenwriting and playwriting, which is what my bachelor's degree is in, and kind of being a person in the world and trying to make meaning out of life. That's a big thing, but yeah.
Let me know how that goes. I don't think I've gotten there yet.
I'll be sure to update you.
That's definitely a place to live, though, for sure. I know that you are a trans man.
Yes.
And I'm curious about your journey with regard to your gender identity. How has that been for you?
Yeah. Well, as Betty mentioned in this great little preamble, I am on the youngish side. I mean, well, now I'm doing my Affordable Care Act applications, which is a little clue about how old I am. I was born before the millennium. But I was raised in the San Francisco Bay Area. I think I started coming to, I took sort of like a long walk towards really understanding and accepting my gender identity for someone who was definitely like, I have a very classical transgender child story where when I was pulled out of my mom, they said, it's a girl. And then when I started developing consciousness, started to have feelings and opinions about that. I think I started feeling discomfort with my gender identity pretty early on. But it wasn't as much like I hated being a girl immediately as just I felt weird. And I didn't like being treated differently on the basis of my gender. I didn't like the things that were meant to be associated with girlhood. I was like a very headstrong kid and also like a very militant, like baby feminist. So
you probably still are too.
Not
baby, but milk.
Yeah, I was going to say I'm like at least a toddler at this point. but I think for me, it was a feeling of just sort of like, I am going to do my own thing and exist outside of femininity. So I was like a very tomboyish kid. I would not wear pink. I hated dresses. I hated my birth name. I like tried many times to get nicknames going that were less strongly gendered because my birth name was a very strongly gendered one. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and that mostly worked for me until it, you know, until it didn't. I think I started feeling a little bit out of place around puberty. I had this sort of realization very early on of like, oh, I am some kind of gay. And I think also like developing political consciousness in and around kind of like 2008, we had the California Proposition 8. So that like gay rights stuff was looming very large in everybody's political mind. And it was very divisive, I think, even in my community. I felt this feeling of immediate identification with like, oh, well, that's bad because that's what I am.
Right.
My parents, you know, saw that I was a gay child and they didn't really have any problem with that. But I think I around adolescence started, and this is like probably 2010, 2011, 2012, right before what I think we usually refer to as the transgender tipping point, which was that moment in like 2014, 2015, when trans issues really broke out into the mainstream in a way that they hadn't in the previous decades. Like the biggest like transgender tipping point thing is like Laverne Cox was on the cover of Time magazine. Orange is the New Black was on mm-hmm. the air, and that yep. was the first like trans narrative that a lot of people had received because it was such a big like runaway success. And it contains specifically like education about trans issues because her character like walks everybody through what does it mean to be a trans woman. And mm-hmm. there's a very good episode where she teaches everybody about their own anatomy in the women's prison because she's like, look, I had one made. I know what it is. I know what it does.
I don't think I saw that show.
It's a pretty terrific. I mean, it has its ups and downs, but it's, mm-hmm. I think as a piece of trans education, it was a surprisingly good one, surprising venue. You know, there was a lot of supportive spaces on the internet also where you could be trans and experiment with gender identity around that time. So I had friends in real life, I had friends online, and I found sort of like that ground where I could say to some of my friends, I'm thinking about experimenting with a different name or different pronouns. I'm thinking about trying to transition. What do you think about that? Would you try out calling me this thing? Would you try out calling me that thing?
That's pretty powerful that you had a safe space to experiment.
Yeah.
And try different things on to see what fit best.
Yeah. And I think it's, for me, it was sort of a combination of, I think once I saw that there were social models for the kind of life that I wanted to live, or there were a lot of things that I didn't understand about my gender. Like I'm not specifically gay or straight. I guess I'm sort of bisexual, but I'm very loosey goosey about it. And I don't usually label my sexuality, mm-hmm. but I think like there were certain things I didn't see myself in images of queer women and I couldn't really understand like what that would look like for me growing up. I felt a specific affinity with gay men and gay male expressions of gender that I like didn't really understand the meaning of until I was given the freedom to say I think that might be me. Mm-hmm. I think having those safe spaces was a really big deal for me. And I think when I came out, like I said, my parents were very okay with me being gay. They were like, okay, we have a gay kid. We can deal with that. And I'm not the only queer person in my family, which is also quite nice. In my nuclear family, yes. In my larger family, no. I think the coming out as trans was a lot harder, like a substantial amount harder. Yeah, because I think part of being raised in a very feminist household is also like they're, you know, my mother was like, why don't you want to be a girl? What's so wrong with being a girl? Why can't you, you know, accept that womanhood is expansive? And I don't think that those beliefs are kind of mutually exclusive.
Right.
because to me it was very important that I could recognize both that womanhood was expansive and that I existed largely outside of it.
I can get how that would be tough for a parent.
Yeah.
The distinction there.
I think so. And I think like that a lot of people struggle with that area, even people who are otherwise like very accepting, because mm-hmm. I think it's a place where you really need to interrogate the ways that you think about gender that are beyond sort of like the second wave feminist mm-hmm. conceptions of sex-based oppression, which not to say that they don't exist, but mm-hmm. there's a whole world out there.
Well, and I have to add that, you know, I think part of where your parents were coming from was even me, who have been, I've been out as mm-hmm. a lesbian since the early 1980s, but things were very binary for us, you know, and sexuality and gender were very much tied together. We didn't explode those apart. That was up to your generation. And the fluidity, I think, Tan Judy, that we've been seeing with having folks like you who are younger and talking with you more, this fluidity is really hard for us to wrap our heads around.
But
it's also an incredibly powerful place from which to live. I mean, the freedom in understanding that your gender is separate from your sexuality, and the freedom to be able to explore what's truly you in both those realms is incredibly powerful. And this is part of why it does us a lot of good to hear your stories, because we old folks need to understand this, and I think for ourselves.
Oh, yes. Yes. In fact, my husband started his transition in 2000.
Right.
So that for me was what? Difficult. And it took us a minute to settle into our relationship after his transition. And I think if that had happened when we were your age, that would have been amazing. It would have. We had a tough time.
You would have had a very different life.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. We would have been married 50 years by now. Yeah.
Oh, well.
Yeah. So I'm very jealous of your young chance to look into that and to sort out how does my gender show up and how is it in the world and all of that. It seems like your generation has a lot of freedom there.
Yeah. I mean, I think that in a lot of ways, and I think that it's also a factor of where I the specific time and place in which I grew up. Because I think the thing that is really, I don't know, that this existential threat that exists around not only youth transition care, but also the right to socially transition and the right to determine who you are in relation to your peers and in relation to, like, your school, your legal name, all of these things mm-hmm. That are coming under threat in state legislatures and now on the federal level. It's really jarring, I think, as somebody who I feel like I jumped through the eye of a needle somehow. 'Cause I came up in this time when trans rights were expanding and recognition of trans people was expanding. So I was still, you know, I would talk to a lot of people when I was a teenager where I was still the first trans person that they had ever met. And I had to do a lot of sort of like groundwork to give people the trans 101. I was really engaged in trans advocacy in the Bay Area when I was a teenager because, I mean, specifically for that reason of just like we needed to expand our ground game.
Oh, yeah.
And now I think we live in this period where everybody has heard of trans people. Everybody knows broadly what it is to transition, but their conceptions of what it is are a lot more fixed based on what kind of narratives they've already been exposed to. So I was really, really lucky to come through my kind of gender identity journey in that accepting space and be able to receive that kind of like community support, because I can't imagine. I mean, I am sure that trans kids in my same school district are probably in a worse position now than they were before, just because of the degree of scrutiny that's been leveled against. I don't know. So
it's hard to imagine.
Yeah, and I don't know any youth who are like going through my high school system now, but I am still in touch with some of the faculty and administrators who were very big, like I think kind of mentors and advocates for me when I was a high school student. It was really difficult. I think one of the best things that talking about my early transition and the kind of reactions that my parents had. I struggled a lot with my mental health, and I don't think that's something that I need to like really obscure, because it's difficult to be a person who doesn't feel at home in your body and feels confused about your identity generally. Young people have a really difficult time figuring out who they are in the world, period.
Yes.
And things are getting even more complicated, and things are getting even more hostile in a lot of ways. And so I struggled a lot, because I felt like there were aspects of myself that I had to hide from other people. I tried very hard to force myself into like a particular mold to see if I could like shake off my feelings of, I really kind of don't want to be a girl anymore. I did like a million sports and a million, like I was in karate, I played flag football, I played softball, I did cross country running. For a while I was doing ballet, and I would show up to ballet class with like, you know, my cat eyeliner, like really just trying to be okay with like seeing myself in the mirror, but not feeling like I was fitting in to like this mold that I was trying to press myself into. And I don't actually think that's an uncommon story for transgender men in particular, is to try and sort of overperform femininity to see if you can sort of brute force your way back in.
Wow.
Yeah. I think what you're feeling internally is not always what you're projecting out into the world. And I think that's why a lot of parents are surprised, especially parents of sort of like early adolescents and teenagers who suddenly come to them and are like, I'm trans, because they're like, well, you didn't ever say this before. It's like, well, yeah, I'm saying it now, actually.
Yeah.
So that's why you haven't heard it before, because this is the first time I'm saying it. But because I was having those struggles with anxiety and depression and what I would later be diagnosed with OCD and ADHD. So I have a whole cluster of things. But I while I was really in the thick of that, I was put into an intensive outpatient program. So I was walking I would leave my history class in like seventh or eighth grade, like 20 minutes early, to walk myself to the hospital down the street to do an intensive dialectical behavioral therapy skills class. And it was like me in a room with like 12 other depressed teens, some of whom were there because they had attempted suicide and had been discharged from the hospital, some of whom were just there to learn the skills. It was supposed to be 8 weeks, and I did it for 10 weeks. And I worked with the individual therapists in that program to try and come up with a plan of like how I was going to come out to my parents, because I really early on brought that up in therapy and in group, and it was like, oh, well, this is actually the most significant source of my anxiety, is I feel like I'm wearing a costume all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That is a powerful realization.
Yeah.
And what great support.
I know. I'm one of the luckiest trans people walking planet Earth. I really am. But,
wow.
But it was still hard, though. We want to recognize that. It was still hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was difficult. I think my life improved a lot after I was able to be more open about who I was, and I was able
to
feel like I was taking charge and taking agency over the direction of my life that I had largely sort of felt like I was sleepwalking through. And
what a great shift.
Yeah. Well, my dad will say this often. Like, my dad says, oh yeah, you know, once we figured out like your gender issues, like you would lock yourself in your room whenever you got home and only come out for like ballet practice. And I had like chronic migraines. I had all of this stuff. And he's like, well, yeah, like after you socially transitioned, it kind of seems like you became this like outgoing overachiever person. Like, yeah. I don't think it's exactly as linear as that, because I think it is like it wasn't easy, but Yeah, I mean, as I was starting to have those conversations with the therapists, I came home one day, and I had been doing some, like, I was sort of into, like, cosplay, if you know, like, mm-hmm. yeah.
Mm-hmm. Costuming characters.
Yeah. I always really gravitated to male characters for some reason. Totally obvious.
Makes perfect sense to this lesbian, huh?
Yeah. Well, I recently unearthed a bunch of old. I was helping I've been helping my parents get rid of some old things because they're about to sell their house, and I was looking at like my old video games, like plugged in an old like Pokemon game, and I was like, oh, I was playing a boy named Kyle. in all of my Pokemon games.
Wow.
I think that fantasy space was really helpful for me. But my mom found I had like a compression binder that I had bought to use for my costumes. And my mom figured out that I had just been wearing it like every day. And that forced a confrontation. And there was much yelling and much crying and a little bit of throwing. But after that, she, you know, I think there wasn't necessarily an immediate embrace from my parents, but there wasn't, like, they were accepting of it. They didn't necessarily try to deter me from what I felt was my, like, experience of gender. So
it sounds like they had a journey to follow along with you.
My parents are great. My dad is always, I think, stakes a lot of his identity on being a very good trans ally, which is, I appreciate it a lot. But he's always sending me things. Like, he's like, my dad is addicted to TikTok. I have never used TikTok. No. My dad is always sending me like, oh, did you see this trans chick from Ireland? And she plays guitar and she makes these songs about being trans and it's so awesome. And I'm like, no, Dad, I haven't heard of that. But I think, you know, it was a walk there. But I think one of the best things that my parents did for me in that early transition period was my mom was like, I don't know how to deal with a trans kid. I don't know what this is. I have all of my own feelings to unpack about gender, and I really can't be helpful. So I found a support group for LGBT youth. Do you want to go? And that is how I met all of the people who would be my friends in high school, and I still know many of them now.
That's fabulous.
That is.
Wow. I met the first trans adults that I ever knew through that group, because a lot of them were group facilitators and social workers who were working with the queer community in the Bay Area, and a lot of them became my mentors and my friends. And I met trans people my age, and I met gay people my age, and I met people who were a lot like me, and I met people who were nothing like me.
Wow. I can't imagine. That must have been so freeing.
I'm told that that organization doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. Oh, my.
I spoke to a social worker who used to work as a school therapist through them, and she says, it's not around anymore. So I hope that those spaces are still out there, because it was remarkably meaningful to me as a young person to be able to, like, sit in a room and eat pretzels with other, you know, like, 15-year-old trans kids.
Well, and you saw it was possible, so you know it can be recreated.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. I think so.
Yeah. Gosh. Mm.
One of the things that I've been involved with probably for the last 30 years is PFLAG.
Yeah, PFLAG is amazing.
Yes, they provide a space for parents to get educated, for kids to come and educate parents and grandparents and get support themselves. It's just brilliant. It's brilliant.
I know that my mom attended a couple of parent support groups. I think that they were run through PFLAG, come to think of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the backbone for me of my education with regard to trans issues.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it definitely was. Definitely was. And I became, like your dad, I became the advocate for trans guys primarily,
right?
Because I was married to one. So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, trans guys need champions too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's see. I'm looking at my list here. I, with regard to grandparents, parents, do you have any coaching perhaps that we could pass on to our buddies who are struggling?
Yeah, I wrote some notes about this in my little notebook.
Good, because some of us have trans grandkids. I do, mm-hmm. you know, and Just because LGBTQ are all grouped together doesn't mean I understood from day one what he was going through.
Yeah.
So, please.
Yeah, well, I think I was sort of thinking back to conversations that I had with my parents and with other people in my life in my early transition. And I think one of the things that I wrote is I think when you're having conversations about gender with your trans kid or grandkid, I think one of the things that you need to do is sort of mentally prepare yourself for the idea that there might be sensitivity, just because it's a very emotionally charged topic. And a lot of trans youth, particularly right now, I mean, I think I experienced this a lot as a young person when my main goal was just like informing people of what it meant to be transgender. But I think now, in today's media ecosystem, trans youth really have the acute fear that they are being, you know, targeted.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not without reason, because they are. They
with
very
good
obviously
reason,
are,
right.
Yeah. And I think that youth in general are not used to being taken seriously. But I think they have a lot of interactions in their daily life where they experience deliberate or accidental misgendering in their school, as they're sort of like going throughout their day. They might be being bullied in school. They might be, you know, have teachers who are not accepting. They might have teachers who wonder out loud and go on tangents about what does it really even mean to be non-binary. Like, these things do happen in the classroom space. Sometimes you do have people in your life who are authority figures who loudly express that they don't understand or agree with something. And maybe they're not even that ill-intentioned when they do it, but you internalize things like that. And my experience as a transgender youth was really that it was like swimming upstream all the time. So there is a level of sensitivity that you might experience because they might receive questions that are good faith understanding questions, but they still might receive questions as doubting or scrutiny about their identity. So I think just going into that conversation, it's really important to let them know that you respect, you know, their identity and who they are. And I think be prepared that they, not only that there might be sensitivity around questions, but they might not be the best resource to learn about trans issues in general, because youth are also navigating these issues at the same time as everybody else.
No, that's a good, thank you. That's a good reminder, because, you know, I'm thinking about my grandson who started socially transitioning in middle school. And I think I did kind of expect him to help educate me about this. And now thank you. This is helping me realize I can do some of this work on my own. And, you know, and it's not his job.
I don't want to discourage people from having open conversations about, like, what does your gender identity mean to you? But I do think that it's the kind of thing that you can, it would pay, I think, to navigate with caution. I see you're raising your hand.
Did you want to?
I know that I spent a lot of time educating my doctors.
Oh, sure.
About my husband's relationship with me as a trans man when I had my own therapy. And I just really resented that. I needed a doctor. I didn't need somebody I had to teach.
Yeah.
And I can imagine kids would feel the same way.
Mm-hmm.
This is who I am. You go get educated and then let's talk.
I definitely did feel that way sometimes.
Yeah.
And that makes sense to me. And what I think I'm hearing you say is trust them to say who they are to you.
Yeah.
Respect, trust them that they know who they are. You know, don't question, don't doubt, be curious, ask questions, but it's the kind of respect you would expect to get as an adult, right?
Yes.
And I think we need to be doing that with our kids.
I think that just in almost every sphere of life, I am always surprised by how much people forget what it felt like to be a young person, what it felt like to be a child.
Mm-hmm.
It feels horrible. It's so stressful, Everyone is telling you that you don't understand things, and maybe you come to realize some things about yourself, and then somebody else in your life is like, well, that can't possibly be true because of what I've observed from the outside. But you're ultimately, your child or grandchild is the only person who's inside their own brain. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think appearances can be very deceiving.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow, that's powerful.
That's good coaching.
Yeah, and how about I give you two a little break
So
from this amazing conversation, but we've got a few little public service announcements we want to put out for everyone today. We want to remind everyone, especially those of us 65 and older, and if you have parents or relatives who are that, open enrollment for Medicare is happening right now. If you have questions about that, the Orange County Department on Aging can help out. You can go check their information out online at orangecountync.gov/aging and look for information about Medicare assistance. There's a lot of great help with the yearly changing Medicare requirements and offerings that we have. It's never easy, even when you get old, right? And the other thing we want to remind people is, please remember that we have elections coming up at the beginning of November. You may think that some of these elections are not critical because they're not necessarily federal. Well, every election is important, period, and it's good practice. So go check your voter registration online. Orange County has that information online. You can participate in a voter registration repair project if you or someone you know is on a list of people who may not get the chance to vote in the next election. You can go to orangecountync.gov/org, that's what I think I'm seeing, and just look for voter registration in Orange County, North Carolina, and you can get information about that. And I believe I'm remembering correctly that early voting is happening now. I don't remember the dates right now for the upcoming November election, but again, you can look for that online too. All of us old folks are pretty media savvy, so hey, or at least we can search online. We know how to use search engines.
You would be surprised at how many youth are not very good at Googling.
Oh, okay.
Oh,
well, you know, but Googling, like we were talking earlier, even Googling, if you don't phrase your search correctly, that's good communication, right? If you don't communicate well, you're going to get junk out.
Absolutely.
So, those are the PSAs for today. And how about we get back to this great interview with Percy?
I'm going to shift to your training and your career building process. What has motivated you to head in the direction you are headed? Does that make sense, this question?
Yeah. Oh, it 100% does. Because I think... So I can say a little bit more about what I've done since high school. I think that my early experiences with advocacy caused me to become very politically engaged. I was, to be honest, a kid who talked to adults. So I was always, when I was a kid, my favorite show was The Daily Show. So I was very... I was very politically engaged from a pretty early age. And I think that a lot of my interests have grown out of my desire to use my skills to just, on a basic level, to improve civil society, to put something good into the world. I started as a journalism major. In college, I did a year of community college in California, and then I transferred to a school on the East Coast with a very good journalism program. And I did 3 years in that journalism program, and then I switched to English. I was double majoring in English for a while, but I decided, that not all of my credits from community college were going to transfer, so I've had to add some time to my degree. But B, I think that I was really interested in journalism because I was really interested in doing research, and I was really interested in the process of inquiry and like the process of getting to the truth and communicating that truth.
Wow.
And
that's pretty impressive. I like that.
I guess. another thing to understand is that like I was 17, because I don't think I was able, didn't vote in 2016. I would have voted if I was eligible. I was 17 when, in 2016, when we really started to see kind of, I think, a lot of the fabric of our information systems start to be upended by, like, mis and disinformation, and we really started to appreciate the role that algorithms play in getting political information to people and in sort of shaping people's information environments. And mm-hmm. I was very interested in, I'm going to be a journalist, I'm going to find the truth, I'm going to get the truth out. And then I think the more that I studied, and particularly, like, I took some great upper level electives on this topic in college. I took a great misinformation course that was offered by like a 30-year Washington Post veteran, and I just became so very, I guess, dispirited. Thinking about,
that's kind of what I felt when you were saying this.
Yeah,
at how easy it is maybe to dupe people and manipulate them.
Well, yeah. I mean, like all of media and social media and politics are like one big superstructure, you know. And like the issues that we were having on like Facebook, for instance, of mis and disinformation, a lot of them were issues that didn't concern individual journalists at all. Like, it was Facebook's decision to prioritize video content over written news content that forced mm-hmm. a lot of publications to pivot to video, and then they went bankrupt because Facebook kind of lied about how much video revenue was. But anyway, and it was like issues of platform governance. You know, do we have moderators in every language
right.
as we're expanding into global spaces?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of content do our algorithms push? How do we keep people on the platform? Do we care about whether the key things that keep them on the platform are entirely accurate?
Yeah, and I remember that testimony before Congress by someone who was with Facebook about...
the Cambridge Analytica?
Yeah, not just that, but before that, saying that they figured out pretty early on that getting people enraged
yeah.
is what makes them continue to engage. And if what you want is more clicks and people on your platform, well, that's what you do,
yeah.
right? You keep people enraged and angry and divided.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's about money.
There's a term for it in kind of media studies world and in communications world. They call it sometimes dark patterns. Those are the decisions that are made on a platform level
mm-hmm.
Of like how do you extract more information from users and more data from users, but B, like what structural decisions do you make to keep them on the site
mm-hmm.
that aren't necessarily visible to the user? That's why they're the dark patterns.
Thank you for sharing that phrase. It's a good one.
Yeah, I think if you're interested in algorithms in general, Sophia Noble has a really interesting book called Algorithms of Oppression. That's exactly the kind of question you were talking about earlier of like the Google thing.
Mm-hmm.
What you type into Google influences what you're going to get back. So if people were, mm-hmm. I think that the example that she uses in her book is black on black crime. Like if you Google a phrase like that, you're going to be directed to websites that are, you know, pushing that worldview.
What's
because
the name of the book again? I want to.
It's called Algorithms of Oppression. That was something that came up in my bachelor's degree when I was doing my media studies concentration.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, like, I have my master's degree in information science. I'm very green in the field in general. But these are just kind of my research interests. So this is something that I think about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I've sort of lost track of what the question was, to be brutally honest with you.
Well, it's exactly what you've answered.
oh, yeah.
Your path,
oh,
what
yes.
has it inspired you?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, yeah. So when I started thinking about all of these things, I spent some time after college teaching English as a foreign language in Japan. I taught high school, so like the equivalent of like 11th and 12th graders.
It was high school. Sounds like a great experience, actually.
It was a great experience. I miss it sometimes for as stressful as it was, I think, to be sort of, it was a little bit sink or swim. I studied Japanese for about 5 years before I moved, which meant that I could have like a conversation. It's like I could introduce myself, you know, I could say, hi, my name is Percy. I couldn't like open a bank account. So I think dealing with that kind of thing, it was a very interesting experience. That taught me less about, I think, information than sort of a lot more about just like living in the world. But
mm-hmm.
it taught me a lot about pedagogy, and I realized that I really liked teaching. And I applied to do a master's degree in library and information science because I wanted to attack information access from the perspective of an educator, like from the perspective of a librarian. I wanted to learn more about how information is created and how the scholarly publishing ecosystem works and how research works. And I was very fortunate that I got all of that through my master's degree, but I got, you know, a little smidgen of it. Mm-hmm. And we'll see, you know, where my career goes from here. Right now, I've been working in like youth theater education. I'm just sort of picking up jobs here and there while I'm waiting for full-time library work to come around. But I hope to be an educator on the library side, or to pursue a PhD in English or communications or education, so that I can continue to teach. When I was a writing coach, I really, really loved teaching composition and teaching research skills. And that was probably my biggest passion. I was like, I am so excited to tell you about all the different types of sources and where to find them and how to use the library website and how to formulate Boolean searches so that you can find the best results on Google.
Oh my gosh, that's a reference librarian geek thing.
Oh,
I love that.
So, yeah, I know. Yeah. So I've always been really interested in the ways that information shapes society. And I think that's why I took the trajectory that I took. Mm-hmm. I'm also still writing, so
oh, that's great.
maybe I'll put on a bunch of plays instead. I don't know.
That would be great. We actually are opening to doing radio plays. If you come up with one,
sure,
we'd definitely be a platform for that.
Well, I will be in touch.
Absolutely. That's something that we have at like an open book with this show.
Sure,
we're open to pretty much anything that comes to mind, that we kind of reach out and find people in the community who can connect us with mm-hmm. things that are missing for us. So that, and that's such a great place to be. Really, mm-hmm.
yeah.
really is.
I try to put art at the center of my life as much as possible. I did about 14 episodes of a fiction podcast with some of my friends last year, and it was so much fun.
Oh.
It was so much fun.
I bet it was.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
But the other thing that is kind of going to bring all this together is, what can we put together that will connect your skills and ability with what we need as queer elders?
Yeah.
I feel totally ignorant. That last sentence you came up with, it was like, huh? So those are the things I feel ignorant about, and I very much want to be able to read the news, read a book, you know, listen to people talking and actually figure out what's the communication here. I don't get sarcasm personally.
Sure.
So I'm at a loss. If I have somebody who's being sarcastic, I think they're that, you know, serious stuff, and I get really insulted or bumfuzzled is my word.
So that's a first for me. I like that. I might steal that.
Oh, yeah. You know exactly what it means, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, I think there are a lot of folks in my generation who feel the same way right now. And if there's some coaching you could provide us, or maybe getting together with us over a beer and, you know, helping us out with getting yeah. there.
Or just some ideas you've had, you know, that yeah. could, because, you know, we are several generations ahead of you. And we saw the rise of all this internet. I mean, I remember text-based browsers, you know, I mean, so, and I think a lot of folks in our 60s and above don't really have a hard time coping with this tsunami of mm-hmm. stuff we have coming at us. And how do we, what was your words, sort the...
Bumfuzzled.
No, the other, sort the wheat from the chaff.
Oh, the wheat from the chaff, oh, right. I saw that.
Just sort, yeah. you know, how do you find the truth, because or the thing that's real? Because I'm at the point, I know for me, I question everything
yeah.
that I see online. I don't, there are a few people I trust mm-hmm. to tell me what I think is the truth, because I trust they do research to make sure they're not passing on mm-hmm. BS. But how do you... You know, you have any recommendations for us old folks who don't want to be spending tons of time doing research? I mean, what you know, yeah. how can we protect ourselves and also be good allies to our younger folks, too?
Oh, I think there's a lot of different parts to that question. I think that I can mostly speak from my own experience. I could talk about my own media diet.
And probably. That would be very helpful, I think.
I'm trying to think of what are the specific needs that you feel like would speak to queer elders in particular, like, or is it just like sort of people in general who are maybe over the age of 60, over the age even of like 55, mm-hmm. who are struggling to navigate?
Well, you know, I can say part of it, and then you can say part of it. Like, I think a lot of folks I know, queer elders and just elders I know, they broke their cut their teeth. Yeah, well, they might have broken teeth too, but you know, they cut their teeth on Facebook, and a lot of them are still there. You know, they get information from friends and family, but they also get a lot of other stuff fed to them by these algorithms.
Yeah,
and so now, how do they protect themselves from getting drawn into that, you know, whirlwind of division and, you know, be scared and hateful all the time?
Yeah.
Any advice about that would be helpful.
I think that this is hypocritical advice coming from someone who was talking about the importance that online spaces played in sort of like shaping my own identity and mm-hmm. community. But the best thing that I have done for myself in the past couple of years is to get off social media. I use like Reddit now because I love seeing posts in chronological order. I hate seeing posts out of order. I hate seeing algorithmically boosted content, which is mm-hmm. why I don't use TikTok. I'm like, what do you mean? It's going to show me videos from people I don't follow. I get very angry.
Stuff that pushes at you. Well, so is Reddit something that you have to go look for? And then,
well, yeah, I think that Reddit runs the gamut so much, right? Because it's just an open forum, and there's mm-hmm. like a million different communities, and some of them are open, and some of them are closed, and some of them are horrible, and some of them are great, and most of them are just complicated and somewhere in the middle of mm-hmm. that. I am so shocked when I log into Facebook. I will log in like once in a blue moon to like update my profile picture or like post a life. Or, like, I posted my graduation photos mm-hmm. this May. And I'm always so shocked because you get caught in the scroll and it's just like AI picture, like,
and that's
conservative meme that I don't know why I'm getting, AI picture.
Yeah, and is there, you know, now you're making me think too, is there, I know I'm getting more of that stuff now too, and I don't go on there much anymore. I understand what you're saying. One of the best things you can do for your mental and emotional and physical health is to not engage with that all the time. But, you know, how about the AI-generated
yeah.
content? That stuff, to me, is getting really scary. I mean,
it's getting a lot better.
You have any, well, a lot better, which is makes it scary because
sure.
it looks really real. And I think people tend not to question it. So, I mean, what would you have any advice for those of us who are older dealing with that? I am also to the point, I can say that I don't trust anything that I don't see from, unless it's from a very trusted source online.
I think genuinely we're all learning about these issues at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I wouldn't feel like you're necessarily much more disadvantaged than someone who's younger just because you didn't come up in the age of the internet.
So we're having similar problems.
I think we're all having similar problems.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
But I think I think Facebook in particular is like very loaded with AI content mm-hmm. in ways that other social media platforms, like in my experience, aren't, or possibly I just haven't, you know, possibly I haven't noticed it.
Right.
I think that as AI technology continues to advance, I don't really feel comfortable giving you like information about how to tell. Like, I right now, what
it's
I
horrid.
Look for is
yeah.
I look for anything that looks like overly airbrushed, and like you used to be able to count the fingers on a hand, or like look for messed up text and writing.
Mm-hmm.
There's still some ways to like look closely at an image and discern based on the forms. Like, okay, this is like pixel noise.
Looks
basically.
Off.
Looks
yeah.
a little off. But I think as we move forward, my thought is that your approach, your like sort of approach to be skeptical, is a pretty helpful one.
Mm-hmm.
I try to make my media diet as sort of diverse as, like, I read the news, I subscribe to a bunch of different like newspapers that'll push me headlines once a day. So
mm-hmm.
I read the headlines, I read the stories if I'm interested. I try and subscribe to some independent news outlets too, to look for like investigative journalism.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, I mean, my sources are a little bit more lefty. Like, I particularly like The Intercept, and they just spun off one called Dropsite.
I was going to say name names because some of us, you know, like, I read news mainly on Substack right now with trusted
Substack,
people.
Substack is a good one. I think that if you have individual journalists who you trust, and when it comes to trans issues in particular, Erin Reed is probably the best source, Erin in the Morning.
I would agree. I think we all read.
I think we all read Erin in the Morning.
Yes.
I particularly like podcasts as sort of like an easy digestion source. So like I'll listen to The Daily a lot of the time, but I also find deeper dive podcasts that do a little bit more journalistic work. And it's really just about finding people who you trust. So one of the most powerful, a couple of the most powerful communicators right now, I think, who have done a lot of work to debunk flawed and misleading data about like trans youth healthcare outcomes, like stuff like the CAS report in the UK and stuff. There's a podcast called Maintenance Phase, which is with Michael Hobbs and Aubrey Gordon. That's one of my favorites, is sort of like a, I mean, they are very cynical and they are very sarcastic. So it may not be for everyone, but that's,
I'm learning.
That was one of my favorite, like if you can stomach like to sit down and listen to like a 45 minute long podcast, that's one of my favorites. When it comes to like academic reading on trans issues, Susan Stryker, who wrote Transgender History, and she has an updated edition in, I think, like 2016. She's one of the most, I think, storied trans academics because she's been writing about trans stuff since the 90s. Jules Gill Peterson wrote a book called Histories of the Transgender Child that I think is helpful for people who might want to have a little bit of a historical look at how trans children have existed in our society, even ahead of this sort of like social contagion theory that I think has really captured a lot of the quote unquote concerned parents. Sean Fay wrote a book called The Transgender Issue. So I think sort of finding individual authors who you'd like to read can help you too. I feel like my work is never really done. I'm trying to like understand the world. But if you don't, you know, if you're not a person who can sit down and like read an entire book, I actually think that, that's sort of like more bite-sized news podcasts can be helpful. And I think that's like, that's a thing that educators... maybe if educators haven't gotten on top of something, it's probably like the influence that podcasts have, not only on like the health and wellness space, but also like on politics, on information, on all of these areas. Because like, you know, the Joe Rogan Experience is like the number one streamed podcast on every platform, pretty much. And it's very easy for bad actors to take up a lot of space in that area.
Right, and they call them influencers for a reason, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it's, you know, and it's easy, I think, to come from a position of it's easy to, I think, to feign expertise and to present like, oh yeah, I like Dr. Oz, you know, like I have, I'm a heart surgeon, I have medical credentials, and you can still proffer kind of like health misinformation hiding behind that credential. So I think coming to things with a healthy skepticism, not a conspiratorial mindset, I think that's the hardest
thing. That's different, right.
About being a citizen now is like you have to be skeptical of everything, but if you're too skeptical, then you'll fall down the rabbit hole of like
on the other side.
The medical establishment is trying to hide these awesome pills from us, you know, and you can end up on the other side for sure. But so that's what I try to keep in mind. I try to keep thinking about how do I expand my personal and political education? How do I expand my intellectual life? How do I kind of like make sure that I don't totally fall into despair in the midst of all of that and feel like I'm staying firm to my principles? So those are genuinely my only media tips is honestly, like, I think that you're navigating it at the same time as everyone and that young people can be just as susceptible, but because we're all learning together.
I honestly, thank you. That's good to know. Cause I thought it was just, we were having it a harder time.
The digital native is such a myth. They don't always teach kids, you know, about information literacy and media literacy because they presume that they'll already know it. It's like how they don't always teach keyboarding skills in school anymore, but you're not actually born knowing how to use your home.
No joke.
You're not born knowing how to figure out whether a website that's pretending to give you health information is actually giving you false information. Mm-hmm. So these are the skills that I think we need to see more in K through 12 education, at the very least in college.
And maybe online education. Maybe you could do a course that people could just...
I feel like I'd rather get a little bit more research under my belt before I go around saying I'm an expert.
But we'll contact you again in a few years.
Yeah, get at me in 6 or 7 years. We'll see where I land. Yeah.
Right. I would like you to send us a list.
Oh, of course. Yeah, absolutely. I will.
I really want to check out a lot of these podcasts.
I wrote a list for myself so I would know who to name drop. I can just hand it to you.
Please, yes. And we That's will great. Definitely, if any of our listeners are interested in that information, you can email us outontheedgeradio@gmail.com, and we will let you know what Percy has just shared with us.
Yeah.
That'd
Thank
be great. You. And I have one more thing that I definitely want to put on your to-do list. I would love to have an improv class for our queer elders.
Yes.
I think that would be fun. So let's put that on our to-do list.
I didn't talk about this because it's my great shame, but I was in a college sketch comedy group for 3 years.
So. Oh, so you could really do this. Yeah. This is not just, okay. That's another LGBTQ senior resource team event. Okay, we'll be talking with you.
Okay.
Yes, we'll be talking
for
with you.
Sure. Have your people call my people.
We will do that. We will do that. So I guess it's time to call it an hour or so. Percy, thank you very much for coming and talking with us.
Thank you.
You've given us a lot of food for thought that I won't break my teeth on. So there's that. So this is our show for today. Thanks again to WCOMLP Chapel Hill Carborough at 103.5 FM and to the Orange County Department on Aging for making Out on the Edge reality. We'd also like to thank our listeners for joining us today. If you have questions or ideas for future shows, email us at outontheedgeradio at gmail.com. Judy said it earlier. Just rewind and go check it out. Okay. Okay. We want to leave you with this inspirational quote to lift and inspire your spirits this week, especially after so many of you stood out in the streets this past weekend. This is from Coretta Scott King. Struggle is a never-ending process. Freedom is never really won. You earn it and win it in every generation. Thank you, Mrs. King. Join us again next week, Monday, 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern, for Out on the Edge. Till then, live your love out loud.